third stage of formation, the novitiate. Novitiate formation should presume a practical certainty about the two things we've just mentioned, at least by the end of the novitiate. I will distinguish between two kinds of certainty. On the part of the person, he or she must be certain by the end of the novitiate. On all three levels, on all three. About what? Now they believe they have the grace, the vocation, to a life of perfection, to religious life, and to this community. Do not, and I've counseled so many after first vows, after last vows, I was argued out of my uncertainty. Now we're going to deal with the practical ways of how do you get people to arrive at certitude. I would say anyone with positive doubt on any one of these three levels, and by the way, let's be sure that they're not just certain about the third. Yes, I want to be a member of this community, but I'm not sure I want a life of perfection. And believe me, people can be so inconsistent. They may like your community because they like you. In any case, I would warn you to not allow a person to take their first vows unless they are certain about their vocation, which means grace, on these three levels. Practical certitude. The second certitude on the part of the community. This creates a problem which I'm sure more than one of you have run into. You, as, say, the one in charge of formation, who by now no doubt has had the conscience of this person exposed to you, may know far more about this individual than the one who is authorized to finally make the decision to accept for first vows. Am I clear? I would say you must be sure as you can practically be, not that this individual has actual fitness for the religious life, but that they have such fitness as with further formation and development will make them suited for final profession. Assume another person may take years. In fact, the church allows, doesn't she? What is it? Up to 5 years after first vows. Is it even more?
6 years,
could be. At least it's a fairly long time. Now, let me carefully distinguish between what kind of certitude you're to look for in the novice. Have you changed the accent? What kind of certitude you are to look for in the novice to assure yourself, and what kind of certitude the novice is to have. The novice is mainly to be as sure as he or she can be about having the grace. You are to be as sure as you can be about the person's willingness and readiness and ability to correspond with grace. Is the distinction clear? Village's life is ultimately a composite of grace and response, or vocation and commitment. What you need to especially assure yourself of, and it's your business to find out, is whether the person's life, practice, habits, disposition give assurance that he or she is responsive to grace. You are to be as sure as you can be that even though there are gaping holes in this person's generosity, nevertheless, basically, this person has sufficient commitment. The individual's main duty during the novitiate, and part of your formation is to help the person do this, is to have him or her, before God, discover whether they have the grace. Knowing whether a person has the grace is such a deeply personal, intimate thing between the God and the soul. Don't guess too much. You should almost take the person's word. You almost have to. Whether in their judgment they think they've got the grace. Your responsibility is mainly to find out, you know, in general, the kind of grace that a person should have and how they're supposed to behave if they've got the grace. Your task is to find out whether they're the kind of people that, given the grace which the church expects of those who are religious, whether they have, well, the willingness, the readiness, the character qualities to respond to the grace. Because, you see, grace is so invisible. Only the soul, and even them. You know, people can struggle with grace. They have to pray much. One of the main purposes of prayer in the novitiate is for the person to be thoroughly convinced, yes, Lord, you are calling me. I do have a vocation, and therefore the promise of grace for the rest of my life. If they can be sure of that, you've given them good formation on the first level, giving them the certitude that they have a vocation. Moreover, and it's almost time, besides arriving at these two certitudes, the one for the novice, that he or she is certain they have the grace of vocation, and the certitude that you, representing the community, have of the person's fitness for the religious life. But there is one other purpose to the novitiate, and that is to begin to develop the grace which should be presumed to be present, even though it may be quite latent, hidden, that is, and quite undeveloped. Help the person, therefore, not just discover, but also to begin to use the grace. Because, frankly, one way to make sure that I've got the grace is to act on it and then begin to see what happens. One last word. One of the surest signs of a person having a religious vocation is the peace of soul they experience in living up to what you, as the director or directress of formation, expect of them. The expectation is grace. Their correspondence with grace should, if they have a vocation, bring them deep soul peace, even though they may tell you, "Oh, but it's hard. And you should say, well, so what? Whoever said that a religious vocation is all that easy, the key is peace of soul.
A grace may be evidently present of a vocation, or it may be dubiously present, but likely latent, needing development. Fine, no problem. But do be sure before the person enters the novitiate that they have a religious vocation. Now their certitude, I mean the person's certitude, may be and often is involved with a variety of emotional feelings and you name it, so that I would say the one who should be less certain, the one who is likely to be less certain that a vocation is present is the person, him or herself. But those who admit a person to the novitiate should believe a vocation is there. The novitiate is not a time to give a person a religious vocation. And this can create difficulties if it is not acted on. The reason being that in the novitiate, a person picks up not a small amount of information, religious knowledge, piety, and external features, if you wish, of what may look like a vocation. I think it's harder after 2 years in the novitiate to judge whether the person has a genuine vocation, this may surprise you, than at the beginning of the novitiate. Now the distinction we've always got to keep in mind is that a vocation is a grace. A vocation is from God. A vocation is in the supernatural order. But in the nature of things, a vocation is given to a human being who has all the natural qualities of you name it. Weakness, fear, uncertainty. Moreover, a vocation is embedded in the human will. God gives the grace of the vocation, but he doesn't give the vocation in the abstract or on paper. He gives it to people, and specifically to the human will to respond to. Now, unless we are shrewd, and I mean shrewd, we are liable to be misled by the reluctance or even the resistance to a vocation or the lack of corresponding with a grace that a person has received. We may not be able to recognize the grace for the resistance. What a pity. Because as long as we can, from such knowledge as we have, convince ourselves the person has a vocation, then reluctance has nothing to do with the vocation, even resistance. Now, they can't be resisting totally, otherwise they would have left the community, or they would never have entered. And I can speak quite autobiographically when I talk this way. All I can tell you is that a vocation is not the same thing as responding to a vocation. And because we see the person with his or her behavior, You say to yourself, if this person has a vocation, I'll eat my hat. Or, pardon me, my veil. I've never used that expression. And this is where natural insight, the study of character, the ability to, well, size up people, and some can do it almost instinctively, is not enough. That's why the single most important quality of one in charge of formation is union with God. To be able to recognize the working of God in spite of what may be the palpable and painfully obvious lack of cooperation on the part of the human being. Indeed, it is a special gift, but I don't hesitate recommending those in formation daily praying for, Lord, that I may recognize your grace in those whom I have been charged with caring for. Do you see the difference between seeing the person in operation or lack of it? All the things that couldn't be more obvious. Yet, beyond it all, beneath it all, in spite of it all, sometimes because of it all, people don't genuinely resist a mirage. Get it? And if men like St. Paul could admit reluctance and resistance, or Augustine, we lesser mortals are known to resist grace if we even suspect that it's there. Most people are not Samuels or Samuelas. Lord, speak. Your servant is listening. So much for the novitiate. By the time the novitiate begins, the one in charge of formation should assure him or herself that the grace of vocation is there. If not, it's not I, the church recommends. The person should be asked to leave. They may get the vocation, because in the absence of the grace, that is the specific grace of a religious vocation, the very novitiate trainee may camouflage the absence of the vocation, because they may develop certain habits of piety. They may cultivate a pious vocabulary. And you'll marvel how this soul is blossoming. Well, maybe it's blossoming, but, well, it's a dandelion. It's not a rose. Be sure the grace of the religious vocation is there. The fourth area, first profession. This is after first profession and prior to their final vows. The time, as we know, has been lengthened by the church, and the one reason why the church has been consistently lengthening the period from first vows to final vows is what this course is all about: formation. assuming the grace is there. Otherwise, the vow should not have been taken. But that first profession needs to be nurtured. They have then, the first professed, taken their vows. The churches giving them the right to take their vows assumes two things. First, that they have a vocation. It is impossible to repeat too often or view from too many sides the definition of a vocation as divine grace for our purpose given to certain people, not everyone, to embrace the life of the councils in a community, which is a good domestic definition of religious life. The life of the evangelical councils in a religious community, which excludes those who may be living lives of perfection, but not under vows. In the world, there can be people seeking and successfully perfection. It excludes also secular institutes, who by prior definition are not members, canonically and practically, of a community. Moreover, on this first level, the church presumes that they have the grace to live these counsels in the community for life. I just recently went over the constitutions of a community, which is part of my, you might say, extracurricular activity, and as plain as English could make it, the sisters piously distinguished between temporary and permanent commitment. What's wrong with that, sister?
The commitment should be permanent from the word.
Permanent commitment from the first vows. Even though the vows are canonically called temporary vows. Although it would be well, I really think so, for semantic reasons, because our English vocabulary is now being loaded with connotations, it would be wise, I think, to not use except to know that it is temporary vows. Never to use the expression temporary profession, but rather first vows, first profession. As distinguished from final vows, final profession. Because the word temporary has been loaded by the Teresa Canes of our country with all sorts of unsavory and even un-Catholic implications. The first presumption the Church therefore makes is that those who take their first vows have the grace for a lifetime commitment. Now, no doubts, and this is part of your understanding of the persons under your charge, while they are, as we see under their first vows or first profession, because religious life is a bilateral covenant, and the term, by the way, should begin to be used. Religious life is a covenant. Contract may be used, but it savors too much of, well, Sears and Roebuck or General Motors. It's a covenant, which is a sacred contract between God, who gives the vocation, and the soul that presumably responds. The vocation is God's part. The response is the person's part. But while the person speaks only for him or herself, the community speaks for God. So that even though, ultimately, the commitment is, of course, made to Christ, who doubts it, on the part of the religious, but because the Christ who now exists, memorize this, the Christ who now exists is the mystical Christ, head and members. Christ no longer enters into any covenant except through his church. Hear it? And therefore, even though on the side of the one who has received the grace, if it is a genuine grace, it is the supernatural gift of persevering in the life of the evangelical councils until death on the part of the one who received the grace. But because religious life is a covenant, it means both grace given and grace received. And your responsibility, and by and large superiors and the general council, depend on your judgment at whatever stage of formation you are dealing with the young, or sometimes not so young. In any case, the reason for what may seem to be an overly lengthy period of, what shall we call it, probation or formation, is not to ensure, remember this, not to ensure the person has the vocation, but to ensure that with such help as the community can give him or her, they will be enabled to live up to and remain faithful to the grace which it is by then assumed they have received. Is that clear? In other words, the years, what are they? Four, five, how many years are they? From first vows? Please? Seven vows. 7 years? 5 years? At least it can be up to seven and even more years.
Christian Brothers, I believe, are 25.
Please?
I believe the Christian Brothers are 25.
You mean at the age of 25?
No, 25 years before they take finals.
The final vows?
Yeah, it was before Vatican II. I don't know whether it still is.
Well, in the Society of Jesus, it's 15 years. And because I finished college before I entered, and I suppose I behaved myself, they cut it down to 13 years in my case. Please?
It says up to 9 years.
So
that's what is there, I don't know.
At least it can be a long time. So that the total number of years in my case, from the time of entrance to the time that I took my last vow, was 17 years after entering. And in fact, it happened to be on the same day, 17 years later. But the purpose of that long drawn out probation, testing, or formation is to help the person develop those qualities of character which a religious vocation requires. And I believe failure here is the single main reason for the calamity in religious life since the council. assuming that those who were admitted had the vocations. That's the first assumption which the church makes. They have the vocation, but they need formation. The second, in terms of their formation, the first assumption, therefore, the church makes is they have a vocation. The second assumption the church makes is, but they need formation. They need formation, especially in three ways: to deepen their faith convictions in the religious life, second, to strengthen their commitment to this life by the cultivation of habits which it is assumed they don't yet possess. And I suppose one of the hardest things for those in charge of novices and finally of major superiors to decide on is to distinguish between a genuine vocation and the obvious need of further. And you can shake your head and say, she sure needs all kinds of formation, but she does have the grace. Now, one way that I have helped myself and try to help others in recognizing the presence of the grace is docility to the Spirit of God. Now, that docility sometimes can be naive. They can be docile beyond what is evidently God's will. But if you've got people like that, thank the Lord, it's those who calculate, the bargainers with God, that you've got to watch out for. And especially the brighter they are, or the better academically equipped when they come, or the more autonomy and independence, maybe from childhood, that they've had to practice because of their earlier life. The more it is necessary to see in the person under your care docility to the Holy Spirit. They may not know it's the Holy Spirit. See, they've got to be told. They may hear voices which are not the Spirit. They've got to be told. But there is a readiness to give oneself to God, which we could expand on. We will say more about it as time goes on, which I consider indispensable as the evidence of a person's having the grace of vocation. And thirdly, they need, in terms of formation, to practice their convinced commitment. Conviction is in the mind. Commitment is in the will. Practice is in the whole person. They must put this convinced commitment into practice, and they should be given every seasonal and unseasonable opportunity. And in the spirit of the community. But of course, not either all on their own. We can't just give them a set of directives. I've never taken a class in home economics. Is that cooking? Is that a glorified name for... Am I correct? Okay. I'm told that even there, they don't trust the girls, though men, I understand, are enrolling in home ec courses. They don't trust them with a recipe or a cookbook. I'm not sure it's true of any of your schools, but I've heard in some places one of the conditions for taking the course is that you eat what you cooked. Which is no more than right. In other words, you don't just give these first professed a cookbook. You give them a chance to put the recipes of sanctity into practice. Moreover, and this I would blame most communities for. When I use the word blame, I don't mean culpable blame, but blame nevertheless. Or with all the demands expected of the older members of the community. Sisters, you've got a lot of examination of conscience to do. And the more we expanded our apostolates, the more we've got to look to this and make a reassessment. What's happening in one community after another, and still, after such casualties as religious life has never known in the history of our country? So, they manage to keep them in the novitiate, and they don't expose them, well, to the four winds before they take their first vows. But the moment they take their first vows, they are sent on the mission. And of course, being in the community by then about 3 years, they're just raring to go. Watch it. I am told by people who know more about this than I that more vocations are lost after first profession than at any other time in the religious life. You know all the factors as well and better than I. Religious life is not lived with complete fidelity in every community. Some houses are more faithful, some less. So bad example. They have just left a period of intense and dedicated training. They may enjoy for a week or two, a month or two, their newfound freedom, but they soon discover, as by now hundreds have told me, hundreds of first professed, nobody cares. Moreover, because they're young and eager, and even physically strong, they can be loaded with work far beyond, I don't say just their strength, but the strength of any normal religious. And being young, they may even volunteer beyond what they're told to do. They'll take this, they'll do that. Now you say to yourselves, well, what's the solution? We can't keep them in formation all the time. Well, I think we began this course by saying, that's right. Sisters are to be in formation all the time.
Part 2 of Father Hardin's lecture on the meaning and kinds of religious formation is found on the next tape.